Well, it's been another extremely eventful week with scientists scrambling to learn everything they can about this new coronavirus variant, Omicron. What they know is that it has a lot of mutations, some potentially pretty consequential. And some scientists are saying that it's probably spreading faster than previous iterations of the pandemic coronavirus. And now some new lab results suggest that our vaccines won't work as well against it as they did against previous variants, though they're also not completely useless. And we've also heard from some doctors in South Africa, where this variant was first detected, that the disease looks milder than what they've seen in previous waves. So where did this thing come from? Why wasn't it predicted? And what does this mean for us? Those are some of the questions I'll be tackling on today's episode of Follow the Science, an exploration of science, medicine, and medical misinformation. I'm your host, Faye Flam. I'm a science journalist and a Bloomberg Opinion columnist, and this podcast is an independent production. We're looking for a new source of funding. My guest today is Emma Hodcroft. She's a molecular epidemiologist at the University of Bern and one of the leaders in tracking Omicron and studying its properties after it was discovered right before Thanksgiving. She and other researchers are employing a whole variety of different techniques to try to figure things out. They're examining the genetics of this variant. They're doing lab experiments to see how it interacts with our immunity from vaccines or previous infection. And they're also watching how Omicron is spreading in the real world.
Yeah, so I do think that this is a surprise. I certainly wouldn't have promised you that the next variant would have come out of the Delta, but I certainly would have said that I think it's the most likely thing that would have happened because, I mean, Delta was, and I to be fair, I think Delta still is accounting for over 99% of sequences coming in worldwide. And so it was really hard to imagine, you know, and the few other things we could see were, for example, you know, little branches of a few alphas, and a few other kind of random things that just seem to be hanging on. I do think that this is another example of how careful we have to be to remain humble in this pandemic, that there is so much that we still don't know about SARS-CoV-2. We tend to keep kind of thinking that we've got this figured out, that we know the road ahead of us. And certainly in terms of knowing things we can do to help keep cases low, knowing interventions that work, knowing that vaccination makes a big difference, we have made huge strides. But I think we have to be really careful in thinking that we can predict, you know, exactly what mutations might happen next and exactly what the selection pressures are that are acting on the virus that can lead to still some very unpredictable things, as we've seen with Omicron.
Yeah. So is there a way to describe how distantly Omicron is related? What sort of maybe where it branched off?
Yeah. So Omicron is still definitely part of SARS-CoV-2. I think that's worth repeating because I have seen some things counter to that on Twitter. We can very clearly see that it's part of the SARS-CoV-2 family. You know, it's a descendant from other viruses of SARS-CoV-2 that have circulated around, but it seems to have acquired a really high number of mutations compared to any other variant that we've seen. So it has a very large number. I think it's about 21 mutations in the very top part of spike, which is the part that attaches to cells to infect them and is also really critical for our immune system to recognize the virus. And this is a higher number than we've seen in any other variant. And obviously, this is why scientists are concerned, because we know that the whole of the spike, which has these mutations, is so important and can impact things, you know, all the way across from whether the virus is more transmissible to, I think, what is really on most people's minds at the moment, whether this variant can get around natural immunity or vaccine immunity to counteract some of the protection that we have at the moment.
Yeah, and so that's really my next questions are about kind of what we know about that and how we know it. So what can you infer from the genomics, and what can you infer from watching how it's spreading in South Africa and elsewhere?
Yeah, so from the genomics, the main thing that we can do is that we know exactly what mutations Omicron has. So we can look and see exactly where these changes have taken place. And that's how we know that these are in these particular parts of the spike protein. But even more than that, we can see if these are mutations that we've seen in other variants or mutations that scientists have tested in the lab, either in combinations with others or maybe even on their own. And so this does give us something to draw on. And unfortunately, this is why scientists are concerned. So some of these mutations, for example, we've seen in previous variants, and they've been linked to things like being able to get around immunity, in particular, infection-mediated immunity. So being able to reinfect people that have already been infected. And we also know from lab work that's been done, looking into some of these mutations that we've seen before, that, for example, some of these might be involved in allowing the virus to replicate faster, which in theory could make it more transmissible. And the main way that we're going to find out more is by looking at this in a lab setting. So scientists are trying to isolate the virus. They can also do what's called synthesizing the virus, where they will put these mutations, because we know the mutations, so they can kind of manually is the wrong word, but artificially put these into SARS-CoV-2 viruses. And then they can grow up those viruses in petri dishes, and they can see, do they seem to infect cells faster? Do they seem like they can get around immunity? And this will start to give us our first kind of real world data points for what impact Omicron might have on these values.
The same day I talked to Dr. Hodcroft, the news broke that a prominent lab in South Africa had discovered that this new variant probably gets around some of the immunity that's produced by the Pfizer vaccine, at least to an extent. These were laboratory experiments where they looked at how the virus interacted with blood from vaccinated people. And one interesting thing they found was that the blood from people who'd been vaccinated and previously infected was able to really block or neutralize the virus. The conclusion was an educated guess that people who have booster shots probably have pretty good protection against this new variant because they think that the boosters might mimic the effects of being both previously infected and vaccinated. How the other available vaccines work against this new variant is something that I think we'll learn a lot about fairly soon.
Of course, there's still a caveat there that, of course, in the real world, it's much more complicated than a petri dish, particularly for immunity. Our immune system is not just antibodies, which is primarily what we test in labs. We have a lot of other, you know, great systems in place in our bodies that allow us to control viral infection. And so even though this lab work will be really critical and it will, you know, it's correlated, it will point us in the right direction, but we'll have to wait even longer to really know the real world impact of, you know, how much less effective immunity is against this new variant. The other thing that's happening right now is to look just at more kind of what we would call the epidemiological data. So this is looking at how many sequences are we getting that are Omicron, how many countries are reporting that they have it, and in particular, how fast cases are rising in South Africa and how much this seems to be linked to a rise in Omicron. And this is where we can start getting data in theory, maybe a little bit faster, because of course, this doesn't have to go through a lab. So we can start getting counts, and already we can see, you know, Omicron is in a lot of places. A lot of countries have detected things that really do look like there's local transmission. So these aren't all just people who came back from Africa recently. The number of cases that are being detected and found in South Africa is giving us some idea that this seems like it can spread quite quickly. But the caveat to all of this data is that it's very early and the numbers are very small. So for example, in South Africa, before this, they actually had very low cases. And even though they did have Delta, it essentially means there wasn't a lot of Delta going around. And so it's possible that Omicron got an extra boost from just expanding into that vacuum. It didn't have anything to compete against. Now, in Europe and in the US, of course, it's a different story. We have more than enough Delta. And it might mean that Omicron might expand slightly slower here, for example, because it has to compete with Delta. That's just a hypothesis, but it's an example of how situations are different all over the world, particularly in things like how many people are vaccinated, how many people have been infected. And it's not always so straightforward to draw a line from, oh, we see this happening in this country, it'll be just the same for us. Obviously, it's still critical information, but it may not perfectly predict what's going to happen as the variant starts to pop up in other places around the world.
And so why would it be able to get around infection-induced immunity, but maybe less good at getting around vaccine-induced immunity? Wouldn't they be pretty similar?
Yeah, so this is a great question. And this is a little bit on the edge of my expertise because I don't work in immunology at all. But from the studies that have been done, it does seem like infection-mediated immunity is not quite as strong and possibly not as long-lasting. But in particular, it seems like it isn't quite as strong. Now, on the other hand, what some people have said about natural immunity is that you might develop antibodies against other parts of the virus. So primarily, you're going to recognize spike because it's the spikiest, sticky it out part of the virus. But you might also learn to recognize other parts of the virus that haven't changed as much as spike has. But in general, I'm not sure we've seen studies that kind of show that this is true necessarily.
I wondered what the epidemiologists are seeing so far, whether it's spreading in a way that you can tell, whether it's rising fast because it's transmitting fast or because it's getting around immunity or some combination of the two.
So that's a great question. And there's a lot of work going into this right now, mostly with modeling. So the numbers are small enough. We have to be really careful how we interpret them. There has been an early preprint that's come out of South Africa where they suggest that the chance of reinfection really is higher for Omicron than it was for earlier waves in South Africa. And so this would imply that perhaps there is some immune evasion happening, that it is able to reinfect people. Now, of course, that's measuring very specifically people who were infected before. So that may or may not tell us about vaccine-mediated immunity, whether it can get around that. But there is, you're right, there's kind of two ways of being more transmissible. One is just that you transmit better, like you replicate faster, or you might live in the nose more, so you get sneezed out more. This is kind of the strategy that we saw mostly in Alpha and Delta. And then the other way is that you become more transmissible because you can infect people that other variants can't. You can get around immunity that would stop other variants in its tracks, and you can infect those people.
What would be the more worrisome scenario, that it's primarily immune evasion or that it's primarily spreading faster?
So this is a tough question to answer because there's a lot of levels even within this. So for example, when it comes to immune evasion, one thing that we've heard, though it is quite speculative out of South Africa, is that maybe infections are milder. Now, there's a counter argument to this that, well, a lot of people have been infected and a lot of people have been vaccinated, or some people have been vaccinated, and we know that that means you have a milder infection. So that we need a lot more research and data to know if that's true or not. But hypothetically, perhaps this gets around immunity a bit, but maybe it doesn't necessarily mean that you have a bad outcome. So let's say maybe this variant is a little bit more like the common cold. That outcome might not be so bad, even though getting around immunity sounds scary. If it gets around immunity, but you still don't get that sick, that's really what we're trying to get to with SARS-CoV-2 at this point. We're probably not going to get rid of the virus entirely. So we'd like it to just be something like, you know, a cold, where it's annoying, it keeps us out of work a few days a year, but essentially it's not a big concern to people's lives or our economy. Now, on the other hand, if it's just more transmissible, as we've seen with Delta, being more transmissible can still have a really big impact. Because if you can manage to infect a really big number of people, then even though the number that might get seriously ill and die is small, which of course, thankfully with SARS-CoV-2, it is small, you know, on a global scale, a small percentage of a big number can still be a very big number, especially if all of those people need treatment at the same time, which is the most devastating kind of scenario that we've seen in this pandemic, where hospitals get overwhelmed, people can't get the treatment they need, and we end up with, unfortunately, you know, more deaths and hospitalizations than we can take care of. So you can imagine that being more transmissible might be bad, even if it's not more kind of deadly. And then, of course, there's...
Or even if it's less deadly.
Exactly. So this, and then that's where you get like all of this range in the middle where, you know, then of course you could have both be up, both be down, one up, one down. And this is why it's so hard to know right now exactly where this might leave us and even what to hope for. I mean, obviously what to hope for would be less transmissible and not immune evasive, but unfortunately that may not be what we've got on our hands.
No, or we wouldn't see what we're seeing. So, yeah. You know, yes, I've seen these Twitter threads. There have been quite a few in the last couple of days saying, well, people don't understand exponential expansion. And even if it's less deadly, if it's a lot more transmissible, you'll see a lot more people in the hospital. And I get that. But it also seems like I was thinking the same way you were. Well, it depends on how much milder it is and how much more transmissible. So if it's a little more transmissible and a lot milder, that might be okay. If it's a little milder and a lot more transmissible, then we're in big trouble.
Exactly. And I think this is the part that we just don't know right now, and that we have to be really careful not to underestimate. you know, and become too comfortable with, oh, you know, I've heard a lot of speculation that, oh, well, this is it, you know, the virus has hit this stage where it just won't hurt anymore and it'll just sweep through, wipe out everything else, but it won't make us sick. I mean, that would be fantastic. I mean, not fantastic because, you know, that, but given the scenario we're in, that would be potentially the best thing to hope for. But at this point, I think it is still, it's a hope. It's not necessarily what we're seeing. And we don't want to go forward thinking that everything will be okay and therefore not taking measures that could make a difference. Now, one nice thing about transmission is that we do have some ideas about how to keep those levels down. The downside, of course, is that they're pretty costly in most cases. But I think we also shouldn't underestimate the fact that we can control this to some extent. We know that masks work. We know that ventilation is important. We know that we can shut things down for short periods, get cases a little bit lower, and then hopefully go back to things that are normal. And it's very unlikely that vaccines will stop. Well, I'd say it's incredibly unlikely vaccines will become completely ineffective. And so things like boosters, again, if we can roll those out, might help to limit transmissibility. And even in kind of a worst case scenario, as they say, flatten that curve so that we have enough people that we can treat them in hospital effectively without compromising either healthcare workers, the people who have COVID, or the people who get sick that don't have COVID.
One of the things that's going on here in the U.S. is that, you know, they suddenly recommended boosters to all adults, and now there are long lines. It's hard to get a booster. It's hard to get an appointment, and even harder if you want to get the boost that's the same vaccine that you had initially. Is there any indication that the pattern is the same with Omicron, that the oldest people or immune-compromised people are the most vulnerable? Or could it go some other way, where maybe kids are more vulnerable?
So in general, with respiratory viruses, we see that older people and immunocompromised people are the people most at risk. So I think that there is some kind of background to saying that that's likely to be the case with Omicron. But it's also very true that we don't necessarily have really complete data on this right now. I think that we can proceed kind of assuming that this is still the same, so still prioritizing the elderly and the immunocompromised. But it is true that in particular in South Africa, they don't have very high vaccination levels, but a lot of these vaccination levels will be in older people. And that might, for example, be protecting them, you know, more than maybe somewhere else where vaccination level in older people isn't very high. Just as an example, I don't know the exact numbers of how old people vaccination compares around the world for every country.
Well, one of the questions I had is, you know, what are the leading hypotheses about where this came from? I've heard a couple people say it might have jumped into an animal host and then back into humans, or into an animal host and into immunocompromised humans. So I wondered what your thinking is on this.
Yeah, this is a hard one because we don't actually know much about the ancestry of Omicron. So one of the things that makes it quite distinctive is that we actually are struggling to find. So normally when we have a variant, we can kind of see how it became a variant in a way. We have like other sequences that go up to the variant and we can see how the mutations accumulated over time. With Omicron, we have what we call a really long branch, and it doesn't have a lot coming off of it. So essentially, we don't know much about the family tree of Omicron. And this makes it a little bit harder for us to then say how it might have come about. And I really want to emphasize that I think until we find some more data there, it's going to be difficult for us to really be conclusive about any of the hypotheses going around right now. Personally, I think that it's quite interesting that we do see this long branch where it looks like a lot of mutations occurred in a relatively short period of time. This is a pattern that we've seen before in immunocompromised patients when doctors have taken samples, you know, they've become infected with SARS-CoV-2 and doctors have taken samples of that over time. We've seen that unfortunately, because those people can't clear the virus like a healthy person could, the virus kind of has a chance to really get a good idea of how human immunity works, and it's able to get a lot of mutations, kind of enabling it to get around the weak immune system of the immunocompromised person. So for me, I think that some kind of involvement of immunocompromised person is certainly very plausible because of this long branch. But it's also really important to keep in mind that this variant seems to have first started expanding in Southern Africa. We're not entirely sure of where it may have started.
What, given sort of what we know, it sounds like the worst case scenario would be that sort of tip of the iceberg would be big enough, if there was a big enough iceberg, to overwhelm our healthcare systems in the same way that they were overwhelmed at the beginning of the pandemic. Would that be, to you, the worst case scenario?
I think that this is certainly my biggest concern, particularly because in a lot of countries right now, we are already on the verge of being overwhelmed. Certainly in Europe, you know, cases have been spiking extremely high with Delta alone, and a lot of hospitalization systems and healthcare systems in Europe are already under a huge amount of pressure. This is not a good situation to be in if we think that there could be a wave on top of a wave, you know, an even larger increase in cases because of Omicron, or maybe more severe cases, or, you know, the many options that are out there. But essentially, we're at a position where our hospitals are already quite stretched. I think in the US, unfortunately, it's heading back in that direction as well.
And what would be the best case scenario that's still kind of consistent with observations so far?
I think the best case scenario is that if the vaccine still offers quite good protection, or if this variant can't get around immunity so well, so that it is maybe a little bit like what I spoke about before, where maybe this variant does move through the population, maybe it's fairly transmissible. I mean, ideally, it would be maybe not so much more transmissible, just because I always, you know, slower is almost always better when it comes to diseases. But the main thing being that it would not be putting many people in hospital, it would not be making people seriously ill, then this might expand through the next 3 months, through the next few months to be dominant. But if it doesn't lead to rises in hospitalizations and deaths and people being seriously ill, then this will not, you know, impact the healthcare system, which is what we're really worried about. And so for me, I think that really we have to not say anything about the severity of Omicron right now, because I don't think we have enough data that we can make a firm statement about it. And I'm not sure that hypothesizing, you know, throwing out conjecture about this is helpful, because we might have to turn around when we do have data and potentially say the opposite. We don't know.
I know one of the things that I argued in the column I already wrote was that there are still actions we can take, even though we don't know that much, as long as they're things that don't have a big cost. One I thought that was reasonable was for the drug companies to start looking into an Omicron-specific vaccine in case it's needed. Do you think that that is reasonable? It seems like the worst that could happen is, okay, they waste some money on something they don't need, but on the other hand, if we have it at the ready, if this thing really does get big, that seems like it could be pretty helpful.
Yeah, I mean, I would recommend that starting this kind of research now is worth doing. I mean, some vaccine companies have already experimented with this a little bit, making some vaccines against earlier variants. We haven't needed them yet, but they have some, you know, this is kind of nice. Maybe it's given them some experience in developing these for the early stages. With vaccine development, the nice thing about mRNA vaccines is they can be updated much more quickly than traditional vaccines. But of course, it still doesn't happen overnight. So for something that we have as many concerns about as Omicron, I think that, you know, early action is better, because it's better to be ahead if it turns out we need it than to end up perhaps that we don't. It's probably still something that can teach you something about vaccine design for that we may end up using in the future. So it almost certainly won't be worthless. And in the worst case scenario, you know, getting those few weeks head start could be really critical if we do end up needing something that's Omicron specific.
We talked about the travel bans that many countries have imposed on Southern Africa. Almost all the scientists who are vocal about this issue are against travel bans because they worry that it singles out vulnerable countries and that it could penalize people who've done a good job of surveillance and actually found these variants. But that doesn't mean that the scientists are against all travel restrictions or against the need to test a lot of people, including people that are traveling around the world.
I think that now is the time for countries to start really weighing up if they still have a travel ban in place. Is this actually doing anything? And what's the kind of fastest time scale that we can undo that and start looking at other ways that it will be much more effective at containing Omicron once it's here and spreading?
Yeah, I think that's been a big point of contention. And yet it seems to me that singling out African countries is bad, but that having people sort of, you know, jetting around the world for vacations at a time like this might not be so great either.
At the very beginning, when a variant is spreading, introductions do matter, unfortunately, for countries. But one of the things is that we often pick up variants after they've started spreading. Still, the number of introductions can make a difference. And it's hard balance to say, you know, when is it that introductions, you know, how many happened and how many are continuing to happen and how much difference is it making to our pandemic?
Yeah, I think that it seems like the reason that to have universal travel restrictions rather than travel bans, and to focus on not letting people in your country, here in the U.S., we have some cases not letting Americans give Omicron to other people by encouraging the airlines to make everybody get tested. That all seems pretty reasonable to me.
Exactly. So I think things like testing, you know, we have a lot of tools at our disposal these days to make testing, you know, widely available, especially lateral flow. We're lucky in a way, that's not the right word, but that Omicron has this particular signature that means we can actually pick it up on a lot of PCR tests. So we can look and see if something is potentially Omicron. It's still very important to sequence and confirm, but we can get a fast result, if that makes sense, for who might have it. We have a lot of tools at our disposal here. And I think one key thing is to make sure that we're using them the most effectively, not necessarily kind of the most knee-jerk reaction choice, but how can we do things that will actually make a difference?
Earlier this week, I also touched base with virologist David Sanders from Purdue University, and we were talking about just how weird it is that this variant that's so unrelated to the dominant variants cropped up when it did. And he pointed out that improbable things are actually likely to happen. It's just that any given improbable thing is unlikely, but there are so many possible improbable things, including improbable new combinations of genes in the coronavirus, that it's almost inevitable that something weird is going to happen. And so I think that in the end, while those people who are preaching doom and gloom and those who are writing this all off as nothing might be getting a lot of attention, the reality really is probably somewhere in the middle. And while it's frustrating to keep hearing from the scientists that they don't know the answers to my questions or that they think they won't know for 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, I think, considering this thing just cropped up last month, that they're moving incredibly fast. And I do expect that they'll know a lot more in 2, 3, 4 weeks. And so stay tuned.
Thank you for listening to Follow the Science. Follow the Science is produced by Faye Flam with funding by the Society for Professional Journalists. Today's episode was edited by Seth Glicksman with music by Kyle Imperator. You can follow us on Facebook for the latest, but if you'd like to hear more Follow the Science, be sure to subscribe on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcast fix.